This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Amateur naturalists have played a significant role in environmental and evolutionary biology for well over a century. The internet makes it possible to organize on a whole new level now. There are now whole websites dedicated to raising funds for research, as well as hundreds of citizen science projects and even video games that help solve problems in research. In the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster 3 years ago, Dr. Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has struggled to find federal funding for his studies of ocean radiation. So in January, he turned to the power of the public to gather funding and water samples for his research on the ecological impacts of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. He joins me today in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome to Living Lab.
My pleasure.
Now, it's been just over 3 years since the tsunami hit the Fukushima region, crippled the Fukushima Daiichi reactor, and spilled large quantities of radioactivity into the ocean. 3 years later, are we sure that that disaster is contained, or is there still radioactive material flowing into the ocean?
Well, you look at it a couple ways. Much less is flowing into the ocean, but we've been saying since the early months after that there was still continued leaks, and that's what's happening today, both from groundwater that gets into buildings and back into the ocean, and now from the 1,000-plus tanks that are on the site storing essentially radioactive waters until they're able to clean them up sufficiently. Those have to be held, and that was ideally going to be a temporary situation, but they've taken much longer than they've expected to come up with a way to treat hundreds of tons of water a day to remove those radioactive isotopes. So there's two sources on land. It's hardly under control, the word that they used to describe the situation. But fortunately, much lower concentrations. It is causing the fisheries to remain closed right near that reactor. Particular types of fish are too high for human consumption. But the largest amounts by far were 3 years ago in the early weeks to month after the accident.
Now, how long does that radioactivity actually last in the ocean, and where is it going to be moving as it flows away from Fukushima?
So one of the isotopes of concern is cesium, and that's essentially soluble. It's a salt in the ocean, so it just moves with the ocean currents. Those move relatively quickly. It's a long ways away from our coast, but 5,000 miles. It's now crossed the Pacific and moving up to the West Coast, and we expect sometime this year to see traces of that radioactivity on the coast of California, Oregon, and up to Alaska.
Now, there's been a lot of concern about the radioactivity reaching the West Coast and whether we might see ecological impacts and even risks to human health. So what kind of levels do we, you know, you said we expect it to be hitting there about now, but how much?
Yeah, that's important because, you know, I was actually surprised by the concern on the West Coast. Radioactivity can be quite dangerous, but not at the levels that the models predicted on the West Coast. Now, so that means we're talking things that are, say, 1,000 times less than what's considered safe to drink. Certainly, the exposure of swimming in it would be much, much less than even walking through an airport X-ray scan or something like that. On the other hand, no one was measuring it. There's no federal agency that's monitoring ocean radioactivity. And when you're not looking at what's there, then people do get concerned. And I think with this combination of fear and unknown with radioactivity and that can cause cancer, and the word Fukushima being a very horrific disaster that we all know, and no one making measurements really brought the alarm bells going on the West Coast.
I mean, you tried to get federal funding and couldn't find anybody who would take you up and actually provide you with the money necessary to go and do that sampling.
Yeah, we were fortunate to find foundations like the Moore Foundation to do work off Japan. When it came to the U.S. West Coast, partly because levels were predicted to be low, no one was following up on it, and partly because this work falls between the cracks of NOAA, an agency that studies the ocean but not radioactivity, and DOE, an agency that studies radioactivity but not the ocean. So we've been falling between the cracks. We've been making our case in Washington. Everyone says that this type of work is in the national interest, and we're seeing now certainly in the public interest to be done, but no one stepped up to the plate to sponsor this work.
So you decided to take this one step further instead of just going to philanthropic organizations who'd helped fund some of your early Fukushima research. You actually launched a crowdfunding effort. You know, there are crowdfunding websites, but you're not using one of those. So why did you decide to do this independently?
Yeah, well, late last year, we were getting asked by many groups, many individuals, you know, could you analyze this sample? We really want some help here. And we realized, well, it's as much about education as sampling. So we wanted to have full control of the content of our Radioactive Ocean, the website we set up. And unlike other fundraising efforts that reach a single goal and then they're done, this is something that we'd like to continue for the next 2 to 3 years. The front edge of the radioactivity plume is supposed to show up sometime this year and continue to increase in levels for the next 2 to 3 years. So we didn't, even if we had one group funding us for their beach, that would have been a partial success anyway. So far, we've had about 30 sites that have been fundraised or funding has come in. And we kind of did it as a group effort. It's not cheap. The analyses take several days for us to process, then analyze on a very expensive, sensitive radioactive detectors in my lab. So it's about $550 to $600 for each sample. And that meant we needed to have people form groups and sort of crowdfund as an individual group, a school group, a beach association, and raise the support it would take for us to send them the 5-gallon container, the kit, as we call it, for them to collect the sample on their beach and ship it back to us.
So that's one of the, I think, unusual things about this project, is that it's both crowdfunding and crowdsourcing in one package, that you need the $500 per sample. But once you've raised that amount of money, you're not flying out to the West Coast or flying one of the members of your lab out there. You're actually asking people who live out there to volunteer to go collect these samples for you.
Correct. And we've had, people contact us who really didn't have the financial resources to do it individually, and we've kind of put them in contact with others. And a few people who've generously said, hey, I really want to know what it is. Here's my money. Send me the kit.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about his crowdsourced and crowdfunded research on Fukushima. It's called Our Radioactive Ocean. Now, let's talk a little bit about what's involved in actually doing that sampling. I mean, is it really as simple as basically just go and throw a bucket in the ocean and get 5 gallons of ocean water?
Yes, it's actually quite simple. We've done one little trick is I want to understand why it might be higher at one beach than another. So we have inside of the container a temperature probe donated by Onset Computers, one of our companies here, in town, so that we can say something about the water properties. We also measure the salt, the salinity, so we can say something about ocean currents, because the isotopes, the radionuclides of concern, cesium, are going to be moved around by those currents, and those properties, temperature and salinity, say something about where that water is coming from.
So how many sites are you? You said currently you have 30 that you're sampling, and where are they located?
We have sites from San Diego up to Alaska. There are some places where we have a lot more interest. You think of San Francisco, the Vancouver, Seattle area. But we have sites there. We have a couple sites in Hawaii. Costa Rica just came on, and someone actually from Australia contacted us recently, and we said, we don't expect it to reach the southern hemisphere. That's really not where the currents are going to go, but they just want to know. I think we're finding a larger interest than we expected as time goes on, and we're kind of happy. It's kind of come in slowly, but it's been a very gradual, steady build-up now of about 30 sites where we're collecting for, including 2 or 3 San Diego and Point Reyes in particular, where groups have fundraised not just for one sample, but for this time series. What's it going to look like 3 months from now, 6 months, and for the next 2 years now, they've raised enough funds for us to go back and send them another kit and get new samples.
How many of those 30 sites are locations that you as a scientist wanted to sample, would find interesting to study, versus how many of those are people who really want to check out what's going on in their backyard?
I think it's mostly the what's my beach kind of group. It's not really as much the science as an education project. We would probably be doing sampling offshore more systematically if we had the resources of the ships. On the other hand, the public is concerned about their backyard, where they're surfing, where they're swimming. So it's exactly the samples you'd want to take to answer that question. So we're pretty happy. The distribution is getting better. We don't have many blank spots. We have a map up. We post the data as soon as we can get the samples back and process. It does take a few weeks for that whole process of shipping a container, emptying it in back. And we post all of our sponsors and pictures of the names and the groups. And it's quite interesting how, it's out of our hands once we send that kit. And groups have formed, like brought the local radio station to the beach, a surfing group in Santa Cruz. They've each collected individual smaller samples that have been combined into our container. They made a vent out of it. There's a group, a junior high school group in Santa Barbara that went to the beach with their teacher and collected a sample. So it's kind of has its own momentum. It's interesting to see and kind of fun to see how people take this relatively simple idea, fill up a container with ocean water and ship it to Hui, and turn it into an educational and kind of a fundraising awareness event in their local communities.
Is there something that you can learn from this? You know, you've mentioned a couple of times that this is, at least at this point, more an education or public awareness effort. Is there something, though, of scientific value that you can learn from this exercise?
Oh, yeah. Right now, I keep telling people, even if the levels are safe, there's a lot to be learned by looking at the arrival of this water across the Pacific, how fast those currents move. The models we have differ by an order of magnitude, factors of 10 in the amount of cesium they're predicting, all relatively small numbers. But that's a big number. If the levels were of greater health concern, you'd want to know that. So we visited the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and we're making the case that, hey, we need this capability in the U.S. And they agreed we need to have the ability to measure what's downstream from an accident like this better than a factor 10 in the ocean. And we're really not there yet. So there's a lot to be learned from getting data like this. And hopefully over time, we're only 4 months into this, we'll build up the capability to do more sampling, say, offshore and actually track this arrival better across the Pacific.
So what are you seeing to date? Are you seeing numbers that are in accord with what the models were predicting, what you were expecting?
Yeah, what's interesting and what people also don't realize is what we're seeing are cesium levels, 137 cesium, the isotope that's been here since the weapons testing era in the 50s and 60s. So a 30-year half-life, stays around for decades. And we measure that isotope in every single sample, about 1.5 of these becquerel units per cubic meter. That's a decay event, is a becquerel per volume of water. And that's always been there. There's already cesium in the Pacific Ocean. What we haven't seen yet, and the important word is yet, is the arrival of a Fukushima isotope, 134 cesium, only sticks around for a couple of years. So a lot of it's already decayed, but it hasn't shown up on the beaches. So we have a negative result, but that's an important result that it's not there yet. And we expect to see sometime this year traces of that isotope. We've seen it, some Canadian scientists further offshore in the Pacific. We've seen it halfway across the Pacific, north of Hawaii and various cruises we've been on, but not yet along the beaches of, say, the west coast of North America.
In terms of expanding or prolonging this research, it's interesting that a lot of the funding that you have gotten, I mean, you said, you know, with the $500 to get one sample, that many people are forming groups or taking advantage of beach groups, but a lot of your funding has come from organizations, not individuals. It doesn't perhaps look like what a Kickstarter campaign would look like with a lot of people giving just $5. Do you think this is something that you can perhaps build on with those organizations and expand this into more of the research program that you would like to? Or is this perhaps a way to gather some data that you can then take back to those federal agencies and try again to make the case for federal funding? Where do you think you could go with this funding-wise?
Probably some of both. I mean, it has been, even though they're organizations, they get their individual members, say, to donate. We've had over a couple 100 donations now. And, you know, they're coming from individuals who might be part of a group, but they organize as a group, a beach association. We've had a few corporations just recently. Lush Cosmetics out of Vancouver, Canada, gave us a significant donation to do 20 samples in the future anywhere up and down the coast. We're hoping we can actually get more of those larger funds in to build capacity, as we call it. I need more of these detectors. So right now, my lab's funded primarily by research, you know, 98%, I would say. And that allows me to have the capability to measure these small amounts of cesium that are already there and what might be coming. We need to build up that if this gets any larger. And so we're hoping to find the larger sponsors, whether they're private individuals, foundations, or back. Still not giving up on the federal government. I think it is their responsibility to have this capability in place and eventually to train people like me. There aren't many of us who do this type of work, and we need that. Whether we build another nuclear reactor or not, we need people who can measure these isotopes in the environment.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Ken Bissler about Our Radioactive Ocean, a crowdfunded and crowdsourced effort to track radiation from Fukushima. We'll talk more about trends in citizen science after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Citizen science, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding. The internet has catalyzed an expansion of the public's direct involvement in science. One example, Dr. Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has been drawing on the power of the public to gather funding and water samples for his research on the ecological impacts of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. He's with me today. But involving untrained individuals in scientific research is nothing new. Amateurs and volunteers have been contributing to environmental and evolutionary science for well over a century. Joining us now to put current trends in citizen science into some historical perspective is Dr. Sarah Boyce, Director of Research and Education at Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me.
We also welcome you to join our conversation. Would you contribute your time and money to support scientific research? If you have, share your experience. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Sarah Boyce, the Christmas bird count is perhaps one of the longest running examples of citizen science. Tell us a little bit about how that got started and how it has continued for so long.
Well, the Christmas bird count was first started in 1900 in response to there used to be Christmas bird shoots. And so people would go out and shoot as many birds possible on Christmas Day. And so the response was, well, let's, instead of shooting the birds, let's count them. And, you know, since 1900, you know, this is an annual event. It happens all over the country. Here on the Cape and Islands, we have coordinated the count so they don't all happen on Christmas Day, so that people can do the Nantucket count, the Vineyard count, and counts on the Cape as well. And so now, since having data on bird numbers and populations since 1900, we're able to look at patterns and population changes and timing of the because the counts are done at the same time every year. And so having these long-term trends, even without an initial research question, has enabled researchers to look at changes. So people that have used these data to analyze changes in bird behavior and in bird populations over time.
Now, you were formerly the program manager for another citizen science project, the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, that was also the goal was, as you're kind of saying here, to track changes, to use the eyes of a whole group of people spread across the region to try to track changes in plant distributions.
Exactly. So, so I'm more of a botanist by training, so I can speak more to the plant perspective. But maybe similar to Ken's work, I know invasive plants and radiation don't often have, a lot of similar attributes. But the creation of IPAIN, the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, was started in 2001 in response to a problem. So, there have always been non-native species kind of moving into new areas, but it was noted that in the late 90s, there was becoming more and more of a problem. There were a lot more problem species. And in an area like New England, where there's six relatively small states, we really wanted to unify the efforts of the six states. And with having volunteers spread throughout the region, we could really look at, first of all, getting a baseline of the plants, the non-native plants that were already on the landscape. And then over time, we're able to kind of track some of the distribution of the spread of these plants. And so it allowed communication between states with, a lot of states having different regulations with non-native species or no regulations at all. And then it also allowed for, as we say, like boots on the ground. So just people spread geographically to help get those data.
Clearly, there's an advantage in having a large number of people to make these observations. No one scientist could be in every place at one time. But on the flip side of that, you're then presented with a bit of a trust issue, a data quality issue. How do you train people and ensure that the observations and the data that come out of these large citizen science projects is actually reliable?
That's an excellent question. And especially we dealt with this a lot with the Invasive Plant Atlas, because we were doing some rigorous scientific and statistical analysis, some statistical research that came out of the use of the IPAIN data, and that was especially in the mid-2000s, was a comment we got from reviewers constantly. And so there's it depends on the project, but there's a lot of different ways that either Atlas projects or citizen science projects can deal with that. So at IPAIN, we had a pretty rigorous training. So people would come for a full day of training for species identification and also how we collect the data. That doesn't work for every citizen science project because some of the trade-off is wanting it to be easy for people to collect the data. Another thing is some verification. So now with invasive plant species and the use of the online data entry, as soon as a new record comes up, there's different verifiers in different counties, for example. So an expert that is can look at the individual record and say, yes, this person correctly identified this plant. So there's some, you know, course level of verification. And then some of it also is the law of large numbers. If there's some variation and there's, you know, some variation in exact measurements, for example, of rain data, the law of large numbers states that, you know, if there's one record out of 1,000 that's, you know, maybe off by half a centimeter or something, then we still stand by the quality of the data.
Now, Ken Bissler, in terms of the water sampling for tracking radiation from Fukushima, you mentioned that you know one group actually was telling people to bring their own little mini water samples and pour them all together into one jug. Clearly, that's not what you would be doing in the normal course of water sampling. How do you know that people aren't, I don't know, filling buckets with bathwater and table salt and sending it to you? How do you know that what you're getting is a really viable sample worth spending your time and money on analyzing?
That's a good question, but I think in our case, similar to these large numbers too, we're getting measurements of the isotopes of cesium that are already there. That tells me already it's not bathwater. We're taking salinity and temperature readings at the same time, so that tells me it's ocean water. And if we saw something unusual, we're only up to 30 numbers, say, but if we were to see something strikingly unusual, we'd go back. We'd send someone to that same beach and location. So right now, I don't think there are too many ways that we can be tricked. You can't buy these isotopes in the supermarket. You could take water from a different location, maybe, and kind of fool us. But even there, temperature and salinity tell you a lot about the quality of that sample and where it's from.
Is the data that you're getting of a quality that you could, you think, get it past peer review and published in a scientific journal?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we hope to do that. These samples, we know the location. We know when they were sampled. In fact, the time. It's a self-recording temperature probe inside, and so we know the exact time that they fill it because the temperature changed. So we actually have a fair bit of information, enough. And the quality, when it comes back to the lab, is the same system that I use for my work and research. So it's the same analytical tools in the lab that we use for research.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking about involving the public in scientific research. My guests are Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Sarah Boyce of the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. We also want to hear from you. Have you ever contributed to or volunteered for scientific research? Why or why not? Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also email livinglabradio at capeandislands.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Sarah Boyce, have we seen a change over time in the nature of public involvement in science? Are people doing more sophisticated jobs than perhaps they were doing 100 years ago in these citizen science projects?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think a lot of the kind of the earlier citizen science projects, and I mean earlier modern times, were more a lot about plant identification, birds, butterflies, charismatic things that people were already observing and just kind of gathering those efforts together. And I think in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a big change. And two of those things were, first of all, in terms of publishing and from a scientist perspective, there's been more of an inclusion of citizen science data into published peer-reviewed research. And so that's made it less scary, perhaps, for the scientists who are trying to collect this data, that knowing that they're going to have publishable results. And so there's been that push in the last 10 to 15 years. But also, I mean, think about it now. Everybody has a smartphone. Or many people do. And so if you have a smartphone, you have your own personal eyes on the ground. You have a GPS, you have a camera. Many people have, you know, internet right there on their phone. And so everybody's walking around with these mini computers. And so it makes, for some projects, you know, pretty immediate. You can take a photo of something, you can collect data, and you can enter it right away. It's time stamped and it's got a, you know, it's geolocated. And then in addition to that, I mean, there are so many projects now that involve real crowdsourcing where you don't have to even get off your couch. You can, you know, if you do Galaxy Zoo, for example, as a project where there's thousands and thousands of photos of galaxies, and amateurs can look at these photos and identify galaxies, and it's something that scientists and astronomers were having a hard time getting that automated, and just the human eye can detect and be better at detecting these galaxies on these photographs than an automated program would. And it's been very successful. And so there's a number of different projects like that where people can be contributing to science and from the comfort of their own home and doing things that typically only a grad student or a postdoc used to do. And now people are volunteering to do it.
Is there an opportunity for amateurs or volunteers to even work their way up to helping to perhaps set the agenda for research, start to pose questions and get involved on that end of the science as well as perhaps just the hands-on collecting of information side of things?
Definitely. There's, you know, in the citizen science as a discipline itself, some people are steering away from that term even. There's public participation in scientific research is kind of the newer term. And there's kind of three avenues. So the typical, more historical ways that have involved citizens in science have been contributory. So people collecting data, providing it to the researchers, and that's basically the extent of their participation. So they might learn something and learn something about the background issues, but they're collecting data and then supplying it to the scientists. Then there's a more collaborative area where people and volunteers are working with scientists together, and that's a little more inclusion, but there's already usually research questions designed by the researcher. And so in the contributory, or the collaborative rather, people contribute data, but they also help maybe analyze the data, help summarize the data, and draw some of the conclusions. And then we're really starting to move more into a third area of public participation, which is co-created. So there's a general issue or maybe invasive species, for an example, and then the participants help design the research questions as well as collect the data. And so that's more where volunteers and citizens can by co-creating the science, the research questions, and participating more fully in the scientific process. That's kind of like where a lot of this public participation in scientific research is going now.
Ken Bissler, it would seem that your project, Our Radioactive Ocean, probably falls into that last category of the co-created. This all came out of a public concern, not as much concern in the scientific community. People are proposing, you know, locations where they want to sample, fundraising for it, and then actually carrying out the samples. I wonder how, from inside the walls of a scientific institution, how that kind of model of science is viewed by your colleagues. Is it seen as equally worthwhile with science that is driven entirely by your own questions?
Well, certainly for engaging the public, I found this, you know, in terms of teaching them something about the radioactive ocean where we live, I think it's been quite effective. Because once you take ownership of the question, or in this case, the sample, it's your beach, you want to know how much cesium is there, that brings a level of interest that you just don't get by writing a research publication or putting out a paper somewhere. So I think it's been very effective to let the public decide where they want to get their samples. Get that information out to everybody at the same time as easily as possible. We've started some discussion with a group that represents, they're called Pitcher Farm in Brooklyn, but represents surfing organizations and producers of, say, wetsuits, and trying to figure out how could you get more people engaged. It's kind of hard to take a 50-pound sample of water, 5 gallons, and then ship it around the country. So we're coming up with ways to maybe attach to the ankle of a surfer a little Velcro strap that has the same materials I use in the lab to absorb cesium as part of that strap. So they would have, we call it the rad band, something that they could wear, monitor their environment, ship it back to us, and then have the app on their iPhone, we just mentioned iPhones, or something like a smartphone, that would say, okay, what are the conditions at my beach? What does it look like today? So, you know, surf's up and the cesium level's okay. We think that type of idea would really resonate with a lot of people in bringing larger audiences to this effort.
I love the name Rad Band.
Yeah. Trademark. I haven't the trademark.
Now, that raises this other issue of kind of the education versus research value of what's going on, and especially with this issue of radioactivity. I wonder if, in fact, having the research crowdsourced is not only a powerful research tool because it's an education tool because people are going out and becoming aware of it and getting involved in it, but then there's also the issue that there's been a lot of government mistrust of the government. And I wonder if you think this is actually more effective because people are doing it themselves than if this had been government-funded research that you'd carried out on your own and then said to people, well, we've gone and done the research and there's nothing there.
Yeah, that's true. I do think being independent helps a lot, despite the fact that, you know, I need the larger funds to do, say, to rent a ship for $30,000 a day to a research cruise. But by being independent, then we can, you know, we don't work for TEPCO. We don't work for an independent not-for-profit at Woods Hole, as you know. And so that does give us the ability to say what we want to say. I'll, you know, if I see something, I'll talk about it. We've been doing that freely since the start of the Fukushima disaster 3 years ago. And I think that helps to have that independent confirmation. Even if there was a government effort, we might still continue this program.
Sarah Boyce, clearly there are so many different ways of involving the public in research. I hesitate to now even say citizen science for the reasons you mentioned earlier. But is there any generality you can make about the education value of these projects versus the research value? I mean, is education usually the primary thing, or is it usually the research value that's driving these projects?
Well, that's once again, it's somewhat a project specific, but I think for the most part, a lot of these projects that we see are more science and conservation driven. So there's like action, and whether it's like plant removal or some action like a response to a disaster like Fukushima. Like I know there are projects related to after Hurricane Sandy, for example, or Superstorm Sandy, for example. And so those are more action driven. Then there's more conservation. There's, you know, what's going on at my beach, for example, or what's going on at my nature park that I walk at every day. And then there's a lot of those investigative research projects, or there's a specific scientific research question. And I think there are a lot of projects where education is actually the main goal. But I think that majority in general of these citizen science projects have some question to start with. And, you know, whether it's what are the butterfly species in my county? What are the butterfly species in my region? You know, collecting baseline data and then using those data to look at changes, you know. So I think there's some kind of scientific question for most of these projects.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Sarah Boyce, Director of Research and Education at Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Also, Ken Bissler, founder of Our Radioactive Ocean, a crowdsourced and crowdfunded project to trace radioactivity from Fukushima. We'd also like to hear your experiences with citizen science. Our phone number, toll-free, is 866-999-4626. You can also email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. We'll talk more and take your calls after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Public funds have long been the lifeblood of basic scientific research. But with government funding increasingly difficult to come by, some scientists are turning directly to the public, to individuals like you and me, to finance their research. With me to discuss the changing role of citizens in science today are Sarah Boyce, Director of Research and Education at Linda Loring Nature Foundation, and Ken Bissler, founder of Our Radioactive Ocean, a crowdsourced and crowdfunded project to trace radioactivity from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Ken Bissler, our Radioactive Ocean, as I just said, combines crowdsourcing, actually getting people involved in the doing of the research, with crowdfunding, where you've got people contributing funding to it. And it seems that you've created a pretty seamless pipeline for doing that. You propose an area you'd like to see sampled, you raise the funds, you know, $500 per sample to get that done. It's a pretty nice back and forth between those two sides. Did you have a model for integrating those two aspects of the project?
Not really a model, I guess, just an idea that the interest was there. As I said, people kept asking us, you know, is it safe to go surfing in Santa Cruz? You know, and all we could say is, well, we think it is, but we didn't have measurements. So given that level of interest and concern, and these were valid concerns in a lot of ways, you can be dismissive and say, oh, don't worry about it. But, you know, people are concerned about their environment, and particularly when you talk about radioactivity, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about what those levels might mean. So it's also kind of a response to some of the fear-mongering, some of the alarm blog sites that were being set up, too, that were providing really misinformation about stay out of the ocean, stop eating fish. Well, yes, I do have concerns. Near Japan, those fisheries are closed. We probably shouldn't be eating those particular fish, and they don't sell them abroad. So there are steps that are being taken that we should be concerned about. But it kind of, you know, got brought home when we just kept getting the same questions from a lot of people about how they should be concerned. And the only way to make that happen, we couldn't get this supported despite the need from the federal government, was to ask people to pay for it themselves. And we're trying to make that as cheap as possible. This is something I can continue at the level we're doing now, kind of as a side activity. So, as it grows, we might have to start doing things like buying new detectors, finding sponsors to get the large amount of money to buy an $80,000 gamma detector, or pay for more of my time to be involved in this type of thing. So it's not quite a great business model, in the sense that the more people we get, the more money you might make, or the more profit. This is not a profit activity. This is a bit of science sense and a lot of public education going on at the same time.
Sarah Boyce, when we're talking about crowdfunding science, there's always this question of, well, what's in it for the people who give their money? What will the reward or the payback be? But when we're talking about actually involving people in the research, that doesn't seem to be a question. It's pretty much a given that the participation in and of itself is the reward. Perhaps being an author on a paper, being able to know and look at your observation as part of a larger data set. Do you think this model of integrating the funding, perhaps turning to the people who are participating in large citizen science projects to become potential funders of that science, is a model that we could see expanding?
Yeah, I think that it's a great model. I'd love to see how it continues. I think it really depends, once again, on the project. So something like Ken's project, there is a need. There are people that are interested not only in participating with manual labor or however they can, but if there's a legitimate concern and people want to feel like they're doing something. And so whether it's if they can't fund $500 for a full sample, they can support, you know, maybe put $25 in and know that they helped support doing a sample at their beach. Similarly, I think I mentioned that I know after Superstorm Sandy, there was SUDS, which is Send Us Your Dirt, from they're collecting sediment, for example. And I think there were a lot of people that wanted to do something. And so there's that kind of action idea. You know, people have different abilities, too, to either financially support or physically participate in a program. And so if there's different ways that people can participate and feel ownership of something, I think that's wonderful. I know that one thing that has come up of a lot of the early citizen science projects, like in the 2000s, like, for example, IPAIN and some of the other larger ATLAS projects, there was a lot of initial federal funding to get these programs off the ground. But after kind of these initial pushes of maybe 5 years, then there's this lack of continued funding. And how are you going to sustain these projects and the staff involved? So while the bulk of the data are collected from volunteers who are donating their time, sometimes their gas money to drive around, and their, you know, data usage fees on their phone, perhaps, there are other costs as well. You know, there's coordinating volunteers. That's a huge job in and of itself.
Now, in recent months, as you say, this problem of getting initial funding for something that's intended to be long-term monitoring and then watching federal funding dissipate. In the past several months, I think we've seen a very high-profile version of this, which is that the Scripps Carbon Dioxide Program, which is the group that has been tracking atmospheric carbon dioxide levels for more than 50 years, essentially the record of record of the state of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, has been having trouble getting federal funding to continue and has turned to crowdfunding for this, and has gotten, I think, $20,000 or so at this point, which clearly does not cover the whole budget. Ken Bissler, as federal funding seems to be contracting, particularly for some of these long-term monitoring projects, is crowdfunding a viable alternative?
It's a good question that, in my case, I don't really have the answer for yet. I didn't start this to replace lack of research funds or to replace research funds in my group. I did this because people kept asking me the same questions and I wanted to answer those, and I couldn't get research dollars to do that. Down the road, though, I think by introducing more people to the oceans, more people to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, what I do, I think we might generate interest from foundations for wealthier donations, wealthier individuals. So I think in the end there might be, and I actually do think there will be, a benefit to the research funding side that I didn't even think of. And I, you know, we'll try and have this conversation 12 months from now and see where it's gone, but and where this leads. But I can see all kinds of ways now to expand, not just measuring radionuclides, but people measuring other parts of the water quality in the ocean and getting that information. I think people really do feel empowered. They want to participate, and it doesn't take that much, you know, that small level. And if you combine all those people together or a group, you can actually do some really great things. So I'm getting kind of motivated to do more of this in different ways down the road. So we'll see where it goes.
I'm talking with Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and Sarah Boyce of the Linda Loring Nature Foundation about involving the public directly in science. If you've gotten involved in crowdsourcing or crowdfunding, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Joel is on the line from Brewster. Joel, have you been involved in citizen science?
Well, I've been storm watcher for the Weather Service for many, many, many years, but I've kind of drifted out of it because my equipment keeps getting wrecked when measuring a rain in the middle of, or collecting a rain sample in the middle of the night and then have it frozen solid by dawn and breaking my collecting item. I'd like to invent one where I collect it in a water bottle and let it freeze and then pour it into something with the same square, same area collecting mouth and then measure it, but I never get around to that. However, I have a concern about how does a citizen get in touch with local organizations, town conservation committees, town, whatever. I have a certified vernal pool here because the wood frog used to breed here every year.
All right, Joel, let's see if Sarah Boyce can chime in on this. What are some of the best ways for citizens to perhaps find ways to get involved with science?
Right, well, kind of on a national scale, if you go to SciStarter, which is a website that connects people with different projects, and you can look things like by your interests or regionally. So that's kind of like one of the bigger projects. But I'd say locally, looking at some of your nature centers that are near you, a lot of nature centers either have their own citizen science projects or are part of hosting national projects. So like at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation, for example, we're part of Project Budburst, which is a national phenology project that looks at timing of plants. And so we're kind of taking on that role and their methodology here at the foundation. I know that through like the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, for example, has a list on their website of like six or seven different projects that they have going on at any given time. So I'd say regionally. I don't know that there's a specific citizen science resource just for the Cape and Islands, but individually, whether it's Mass Audubon, I know on Nantucket we also have the Mariah Mitchell Association, and they have a number of different citizen science projects as well. So I think like finding your local nature center and finding the projects that are available. If you are a little bit more motivated and you want to start your own project, going to something like SciStarter, where there's a number of different national projects, and maybe you could be the local leader. You know, there's a the project that we just joined at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation is the acronym is COCORAS, so the Community Collaborative Rainfall, Snow, and Hail Network, or Hail and Snow Network, which is an organization that's been collecting precipitation data throughout the country. And by collecting with the standardized data collection, the same equipment throughout the whole country, it's like $30 for a rain gauge. And then collectively, that data is being used by the National Weather Service, by a number of different organizations and researchers using that precipitation data because it's collected in the same manner throughout the country. So those are kind of some of the examples of projects that are really easy to get involved with right away.
Great. Now, Joel also brought up this other issue talking about his own broken equipment, but Ken Bissler, on the scale of your lab, crowdfunding isn't necessarily going to cover the cost of the equipment that you use for the analysis or just generally maintaining a lab. So could crowdfunding ever really replace federal funding?
I don't think it replaces it. It certainly, in this case, supplements our ability to reach out and talk to the public. It's motivated me to give more lectures to public audiences. I'm heading to the West Coast, up and down from Santa Barbara to Vancouver, giving 5 talks in about a week from now. And it's kind of made me step back a bit and say, you know, if people really care, what do they really care about? You know, is it safe? What's considered dangerous levels of radioactivity? And provide that in an easy-to-digest kind of form on our website. And what struck me the most aren't the 300-odd donations. That's been great. We've been able to launch several sites. But the 110,000 people have actually come to look for information. So obviously, there's a need for this type or an interest in learning more about the radioactive world we live in. And I think that's something that we can do quite well with this type of model.
In just the few seconds that we have left, turning things over to crowdfunding, even partly, puts decisions directly in the public's hand, essentially about which research is worth funding and worth doing. Do you see that as a positive direction or something kind of scary for basic research?
Ooh, in some ways, that is kind of scary. You know, I'm used to making a case to my peers to fund my research. And so having the public pick things, I think they could pick and choose the wrong things. So having it supplement what we're doing already, I don't see it as replacing it. Just for that would be one of the reasons, that they would be not necessarily setting the top priorities, but picking something that might be the flavor of the month.
That's Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, founder of Our Radioactive Ocean, a crowdsourced and crowdfunded project to track radiation from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. I've also been speaking with Sarah Boyce, Director of Research and Education at Linda Loring Nature Foundation, formerly the Program Coordinator for the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, or IPAIN, a crowdsourced way of tracking invasive plants. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You can find links to all of the crowdsourced and crowdfunded science projects we mentioned today on our website, capeandislands.org. Click on Living Lab under the program menu. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.